are back with episode 711 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, but tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and while we don't usually touch on politics or sports ball stuff, I did want to offer, after the sturm und drang of the last week in my home country, a hearty congratulations to Wales for deciding to hang out in the European Championships far longer than England did. However, given what's been going on in Cardiff for the last decade or so, they might have had the help of a mysterious coach.
You don't say.
Jeez, and with our reference to show 7-Eleven, I was going to make a Slurpee reference, but I was shocked to hear sports news from you, so it threw me off my game.
I'll just say, if we're going to make a 7-Eleven reference, how much awesome anime-related stuff do they sell at 7-Elevens in Japan anyway? Jeez. Anyhow, we are going to be getting into the news from this past week. It's a little bit sparse compared to perhaps weeks past, but there we are. We still have some other topics that we can get into that we have been holding on to a little bit. And we do, in fact, have to get started on our annual wrap-up, which, we're a little bit later. We usually do it in June, but we had some other things going on in June. So we're going to do it this time in July. So there we are. But in the meantime, Edmund, why don't you go ahead and give a disclaimer of some kind or another?
Absolutely. We will, as always, spoil you with whatever we tell you. If it's the news, we hope it's stuff you want to hear. If we start discussing certain movies or TV shows, etc., you will definitely have wanted to see them before we do that.
That's right. And, we're going to go ahead and start with the news because that's the most logical place for us to start. And, we don't have a headline story per se. We just have a few stray news items here. And we're going to start off with some basic information out of ABC. Gary?
Yeah. Like you said, nothing earth-shattering. And in some ways, you might even be a little sad when you hear it. Not that it's bad news by any means. Of course, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was announced for renewal. And it's been announced that Season 4 will start off on September 20th, which is a Tuesday, in the 10 p.m. time slot. Obviously not the ideal place to have the show. However, it still is a fourth season, and you know, with various time delays now being accounted into for ratings purposes, hopefully it won't be too much of a drop for the show. They did show us a teaser, in case you did miss it, that as Season 4 opens, they're going to be jumping ahead 6 months. Daisy is a bank-robbing fugitive going by her codename Quake. And it appears that our wonderful Agent Coulson is no longer Director Coulson, and he's working with Mac to bring Daisy in. So, believe it's about a six-month jump ahead from where we ended Season 3 at, hopefully might shake things up a little bit and put a little, maybe a renewed interest in the show as they shake up the storyline a little bit. Typically, when they do these six-month jumps in shows, usually there is a somewhat of a drastic change or at least a significant one. So I'm hoping that's exactly what we see.
Mm. Yes, and of course it is a time slot that's been near and dear to some of our hearts in for the last 5 years or so, so it's nice to know that there is a show that I can watch in that time slot, even though it, of course, will not be on CBS.
It's so convenient of CBS to actually, you know, clear that space.
Clear the space, exactly.
But there we are. Okay, well, we're just going to move on to our next item here. And this is, speaking of things that probably should not have been renewed before a person of interest, just saying. Turns out that after only 5 episodes, AMC has renewed Preacher for a second season. According to Variety, the second season will expand, in quotes, to 13 episodes in 2017. The first season has performed quite well, actually, on AMC, as the number 2 series on the cable channel, with an average of 3.3 million viewers per episode in Nielsen Live Plus 3 ratings. I like the way they describe this. Preacher is a special television program.
I've seen this, yes.
And we're eager to share with fans the rest of this wild first season and now an expanded second season, AMC president Charlie Collier said in a statement. What Sam, Seth, Evan, and the entire creative team have achieved in bringing Garth Ennis' graphic novel to the screen is extraordinary. We look forward to more time with these unforgettable characters, be it in Heaven, Hell, Texas, or beyond.
Mm.
AMC is set to air a Preacher catch-up marathon that will show the first 5 episodes of the series starting on at 9 o'clock on the 30th of June, which is, well, already past for those who are listening to this.
Yes.
But there you are. Preacher gets a second season.
Yes, and I guess they are just hoping that by sometime in that second season, we'll start making sense of what's going on. But we'll get into that later in the week.
I was hoping before then, but I'll take it, I guess. Yeah. I suppose. okay.
Yeah, I will also mention, because I was rather amused when it popped up on the DVR, because for some, I guess they labeled them as new episodes, but they were listing these five marathon episodes as as special editions. But all it meant was they inserted some of those behind the scenes interviews with the actors about various scenes. Because when I first saw that, I was really thinking along the lines of, oh, they realized they had to add some stuff to try and make it more comprehensible, but no, not really.
Edmund, they said it themselves. It's special.
Yes.
Oh boy. Moving on then to our friends on the online, or otherwise known as alternative networks. Edmund, speaking of special decisions.
Yes. Well, Netflix, of course, has been known for rebooting various series, even if not necessarily all the ones we want to see rebooted. And the latest one that they have announced is that they have ordered a first season of Lost in Space. Yes, indeed. The Irwin Allen 1960s sci-fi drama that, actually, if I remember correctly, was the reason CBS did not take Star Trek, because they already had a sci-fi program. But this new incarnation will be showrun by Matt Sazema and Dirk Sharpless from Dracula Untold, and Zach Estrin from Prison Break. Once again, following the Robinson family, stranded light years from where they were supposed to be headed, and finding themselves battling strange and new alien environments, and also their own personal demons. Cindy Holland, the Netflix vice president of original statement, said the original series so deftly captured both drama and comedy, and that made it very appealing to a broad audience. The current creative team's reimagining of the series for Netflix is sure to appeal to both fans who fondly remember the original and create a new generation of enthusiasts around the world. And also involved is Neil Marshall, who directed The Descent and various episodes of Game of Thrones, and is currently slated to direct multiple episodes of the 10-episode first season. And I'd actually forgotten this, that the original ran from 1965 to 1968, was set in 1997, and of course it was rebooted as a movie back in 1998, which has some appeal to some, but was not that great a success. And since 2000, and Kevin Burns, the executive producer of this version, has been working with Irwin Allen's widow Sheila, who died in 2013, to bring back the series. And so they've had a couple of false starts, but are happy to see it coming to Netflix. And of course, this joins the roster of reboots at Netflix that has included Arrested Development, Fuller House, Wet Hot American Summer, and The Gilmore Girls.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and of course, no word yet on casting, so who knows what we're in for on that note. Speaking of note, Netflix has begun filming its Death Note adaptation. Yes, not long after Netflix announced they would be creating an adaptation of the popular Japanese manga anime Death Note, apparently principal photography has already begun on set. The American adaptation will certainly be a departure from previous films and entries, as the cast will have Nat Wolff of Paper Towns portraying the formerly Japanese Light Yagami, now Light Turner. I'm expecting then for the internet to explode any day now with the whitewashing discussion. Yes. As far as the casting is concerned. However, as this article points out, the Japanese have made many different adaptations of Death Note over the years, including their own live-action films, and they're not particularly good. So you always could go and watch the Japanese live-action film and see what that's like, or give this a chance and see if maybe Netflix, well, perhaps not casting exactly the way we would all like it them to, they might actually be able to adapt the material a little bit better. Who knows? It's possible, right? Maybe? Apparently, this is going to be a fairly strict interpretation of the manga, too. So those who are more familiar with the anime, this is going to be perhaps a bit different. So there we are. With that, and Netflix continuing, as we just were talking about nothing but Netflix, yes, they are still holding the banner when it comes to online alternative content. Moving on to movie news. Gary.
Could I put a preliminary, I'm not responsible for any puns in the story, and believe it or not, it is all true. That being said, what we're announcing is we've got more information about the Tetris movie that we've mentioned in the past. They've mentioned that the Tetris movie will be the first part of a trilogy. Or if you prefer a tetralogy. I gave fair warning. Anyway, and the reason they say that is because the story that they have conceived about Tetris is so big, it requires that length.
Wait. So basically, let me just make sure I understand. The plot elements of this story, they can't get them to fit together into one film.
To quote the producer directly, this isn't us just splitting one of our last eight movies into two to wring blood money out of a stone. It's just a big story.
Oh, okay. So basically, they don't have someone on staff, perhaps the writing staff, that could possibly fit these plot elements together in a more compact fashion. So everything lines up into one film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that we explored the full range of meta in this particular article.
The official title is the Untitled Tetris Sci-Fi Project.
The funny thing is, this actually, I'm not going to defend it necessarily. I'm just thinking to myself that this sounds like one of those awesome, like, writing prompt things. That just like, okay, I'm going to have you combine, like, military sci-fi and Tetris. Go. And usually, yes, it's insanity and it doesn't work out. But I'm just thinking to myself, there was someone who once said to Jim Butcher, Roman Empire and Pokemon. And he wrote the Codex Alera. It worked out pretty well. Not everyone, however, is Jim Butcher. If they said Jim Butcher was writing the scripts for the Tetris trilogy, I might be ever so slightly less skeptical, but...
Okay, now the guy who is trying to pull this off is named Larry Kazanov, and he does have credits both working on the Mortal Kombat movie that was recently out, as well as executive producer credits on the True Lies movie. And not to help this case at all, but they said, we're not just going to have blocks with feet running around the movie. Well, it's great that people think so. It sets the bar rather low. This is the filmmaker who's coming up with this.
Yeah.
But as I said, there's a bunch of different varying quotes from this. We don't have casting information. We don't have release dates at this time, so it's still extremely vague. And I do have to agree with him in his the final quote from the news article that we've found this under. No one has come remotely close to figuring out what we're doing.
I don't think he's talking about the press or the public. I think he's talking about the production staff.
Yes.
No one here has come close to knowing what we're doing.
Yeah, so that's these are all his varying quotes that, gosh... I enjoyed the little, the Russian block game as much as anyone else, and I've dropped a few quarters in my day on it, but, they're going to remake the song too, guys, so just in case you like the old one. Oh, don't worry about that. They're going to take care of that because, that's so old.
Is it going to be a Fallout Boy and Missy Elliott by any chance?
They won't say. All they can say is, I guarantee you it's not what you think. So hey,
that's been true for this whole topic.
Again, these all complete vague with you have no idea. I don't think we have an idea. So
except
we've got a lot of it. So
there's this little movie that Disney put out about a character that was going around in various video game worlds and just causing an awful lot of ruckus. I think we need some news. Hey, Edmund.
Yes.
Yeah, could you give me some better video game news? Yeah.
Yes. Well, this is news that Wreck-It Ralph will in fact be back for a sequel, and it is in production, will be released March 9th, 2018, but this is going to be an internet-centric sequel. Co-directed by Rich Moore, who co-directed the original, and Phil Johnson, who helped out with the writing on both Wreck-It Ralph and Zootopia. John C. Reilly, who is, the voice of Ralph, has made the announcement, also joked about the fact that he's mentioned the project numerous times in the press over the last few years. Naturally, it is up on Facebook. The live feed, when it aired live, there was a glitch just as Reilly was about to talk about the plot, which wasn't supposed to happen, but actually wound up being perfect, since, of course, that's kind of one of the points of the movie. So this time, this is Ralph. Ralph's wrecking is wreaking havoc on the web, as only he can do. Characters we loved in the first film are back. We're ecstatic to be working with them. them and the actors who voice them once again. So far, only Riley and Sarah Silverman are officially announced. And saying the world of the they are saying the world of the internet is the perfect place to send Ralph and Vanellope. The scope and scale are so vast, and the possibilities for comedy are endless. With the move to the internet, many may wonder how the world of classic video games will play into the film. Speaking to Collider, Moore said, we're really trying to find that balance of how can we have these great kind of references to retro arcade culture, but also have it feel that this is also a contemporary world with newer games and everything you can find on the internet. There's another film that moved, but as a result of this, but yes,
everything you can find on the internet. we want to put that into Wreck-It Ralph just be that. Wow, things took a left turn in that film. Apparently, no, I'm sure that they will sanitize accordingly.
Yes, I'm pretty sure Safe Search will be on.
Yeah, I would hope so. All right, well. I don't know how much to take this next article seriously, because it seems like every time something like this is announced, it gets reversed.
Yes.
But let's go for it. Let's go for it. As it says here, get your Jaegers ready. The Pacific Rim sequel is coming in 2018. Apparently they have dated it now. And boy, the image that they have here, that silhouette looks awfully... Anyway, John Boyega will be kicking some kaiju ass on the 23rd of February 2018, apparently. That's when the untitled Pacific Rim sequel, directed by Steven S. DeKnight, will now be hitting theaters. So, yes, they have a director, they have a lead actor, they have a date. Come on. It's Steven DeKnight. I think that we have some pretty good reason to think that he knows how to deliver action.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So Guillermo del Toro will be executive producing the sequel to his 2013 film, which continues the futuristic story where humans drive massive robots called Jaegers against an invading alien race. Sounds awfully... the film was previously announced for 2017, but was moved off the schedule last year when del Toro left as director. Now it's back and the apocalypse once again begins in February 2018. The apocalypse, huh? Okay. For my purposes, the first one continues to be a fairly entertaining film, so I'm looking forward to see how they kind of expand on it, especially with someone like DeKnight at the helm.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I'm very happy that this at least for now is on again, and crossing my fingers it does look pretty definite, at least is far more definite than some of the previous.
Than it has previously. Yeah. Although this, you know, this is one of those productions that just seems to be cursed to a certain degree. Although it really honestly Del Toro's track record with getting major projects going has not been good in the last several years. I mean, wasn't he the one who was attached to The Hobbit for a while? And that kind of fell apart. And then he had that big Silent Hill revival game with Norman Reedus that just went nowhere. That was also, involving a couple other people. But that kind of blew up on him. I just want Del Toro to have one of his projects actually land. That would be nice.
Yes.
Anyway, that's it for movie news, which means that we can move on to casting news. And Edmund, you can start here with... Oh, okay.
This is casting news for the Blade Runner sequel. Latest cast member is Barkhad Abdi, the Academy Award nominated actor, best known for his work on Captain Phillips as the chief pirate. And he is joining, of course, Ryan Gosling, Robin Wright, Ana de Armas, Sylvia Hoeks, Carla Jury, Dave Bautista, and of course Harrison Ford, who is reprising his role as Rick Deckard. That's about all we know for sure, since plot and actual characters is being very closely guarded. We do know that Denis Villeneuve, who directed Sicario, is directing, and the production is actually going to start shooting next month.
Yeah, I'm sorry if I sounded just a little skeptical when I started off or passed the torch over, but or the baton, so to speak. But I'm still not sold on the need for a Blade Runner sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying.
Neither. I did forget to mention that production starting next month and currently scheduled to be in theaters October 7th, 2017.
Okie dokie then. Next on the list is a sequel that we're all looking forward to a heck of a lot more, and that would be some casting news regarding Kingsman: The Secret Service's sequel. Vinny Jones is joining the cast, reuniting him with director Matthew Vaughn, who produced Jones' acting debut in Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. Jones tweeted pictures of him with Vaughn and Julianne Moore from the set of the sequel entitled Kingsman: The Golden Circle. Although Jones' role has yet to be disclosed, the actor is best known for playing bad guys. That's saying at least.
Yeah.
With Moore rumored as the film's villain earlier this year, their photo together could hint at an alliance between her character and Jones. Mm-hmm. The source material, the Kingsman comic book, has no sequel, which also opens up the possibility that Jones could be a secondary villain or even the film's main antagonist. So, yeah. It seems like pretty perfect casting, but perfect casting seems to be the words that one could use for the Golden Circle quite often.
In general, yes.
Yes. That film, by the way, is coming before either of the other two that we mentioned, release dates for June 2017. So a year from now, roughly.
Yes.
A little less than a year from now, actually. Yes. Exciting, exciting. All right. Edmund. you got to love the title for this one.
Yes. Apparently, the Walking Dead is going to add two new characters who we assume will eventually die horribly. Of course, we still don't know who, in fact, will be dying from an acute case of Louisville Slugger Syndrome when The Walking Dead returns for its seventh season premiere, but it might be some consolation to know that they will not be understaffed for long. With two new characters being added to the cast, they are apparently exclusive to the TV series. This is from TV Line and Michael Osiello. Naomi is a grandmotherly type who, having lost so many loved ones, is now willing to do whatever it takes not to have to bury any more. And on the flip side is Jenny, a sunny-side-up kind of teenager. Oh, Carl, who sounds a lot like Beth 2.0, kind with a world-weary toughness.
Oh, she'll die fast. Yes. I mean, good luck. Yeah. That should be interesting to see how those people fare in the world, the wider world that Team Grimes has found itself in. Batter up, Buttercup.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Gary, this is news that I'm curious to get your take on.
Oh, geez. You know, if you had told me this news a month ago, I would have been much less excited about it than I am saying it, talking about it today. The news we're talking about is casting for CW show Arrow. And the title of the news that we're discussing is that the Green Lantern connection grows. Now, if you've been an eagle-eye watcher of Arrow, you've seen various references to Ferris Airlines as well as Coast City, Hal Jordan Green Lantern's sort of home base. And it's been, you know, popping up reasonably enough that, of course, it has us all giddy. What they have announced is not Hal Jordan, but a rather minor character in the Green Lantern universe. A journalist from Coast City named Susan Williams will be cast and be appearing on Arrow. Now, what's so important about Susan Williams? Well, again, it's a small connection. However, in the comics, Susan Williams married Hal Jordan's younger brother, Jim, and took the name of Jordan and became Susan Jordan. Now, what this means, I'm not sure, but with the, for me, earth-shattering news that they actually are going to have Superman appear in Supergirl, all of a sudden, it makes a lot more sense that Green Lantern might pop up in Arrow at some point. Just as a side note for people who are rather new to the universe, or at least the comic universe, and wondering what's the push for Green Lantern. Well, they had a award-winning series for about 10, 11 years where Green Arrow and Green Lantern both titled a comic book, and it sold for very good numbers at the time, and and has several issues devoted to not only teen drug use, believe it or not, but as well as racial issues. And they felt it received multiple awards and is still rather highly thought of that it was willing to tackle these issues. A lot of people felt that Green Lantern's sort of, starfaring and Green Arrow's street living were a nice juxtaposition to argue various issues of the day. And while I don't know if you could actually go into that type of thing nowadays without boring certain sections of the audience, I'm encouraged that we might actually manage to get some thoughtful discussion in between the boxing glove arrows and the ring creations. So who knows what will happen, but if they do, it would be nice. And if they even think about possibly handling any controversial subjects, that'd be interesting as well.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's interesting that they keep on hinting at this without actually saying that they're going to go there. as far as the Green Lantern connections go. But yeah, they really seem to be like fleshing out the world around Green Lantern.
Well, I mean, it's always been a hard fit. You know, it's much like when they have to honestly put Superman and Batman together. They really exist in such different worlds that to have them find common ground and both sort of share in the process of resolving an issue is a very difficult writing chore. So they've been doing pretty amazing things. So I have hope for this current writing staff that they can piece something like that together to make it work. And I think they can do that without making Green Lantern per se. He doesn't have to be a super goofy or giddy type of guy. I think he could easily be a very sort of quasi grizzled, Air Force veteran who, has seen a lot type of thing. So we'll have to see what happens. But I'm hopeful that this is actually really showing that they are going to at least dip their toe into it a little bit more.
Indeed. Speaking of dipping their toe into further casting for the DCW shows, we have an interesting bit of casting for The Flash. As it says here, The Flash just got a touch more magical. Harry Potter star Tom Felton has joined the hit CW show as series regular character Julian Dorn, who TV Line describes as a fellow CSI at the Central City Police Department who suspects there's more to Barry Allen than just his good guy reputation. Could be because Barry Allen's the main character. Anyway, the character sounds very familiar to one described in an early report that revealed that The Flash was looking to cast Barry's slightly older, slightly geekier contemporary, a guy who is as smart as he is intuitive. As such, this newcomer doesn't buy Barry's nice guy routine and sets to learn what he's hiding, all while concealing some secrets of his own.
Of course.
Does this sound to you, Gary, like anybody from the Flash comics that you're familiar with, or?
I can't say that there's a single person that comes to mind. Actually, the Linda Park character sort of filled some of that role at some point, but since they've already had her and cast her and sort of used that character, I'd be surprised that they're sort of going after that again. But at one time, she was that one that was sort of looking into The Flash as a reporter. So we'll have to see what happens. But I don't think there is a direct connection to this one the way that they often do.
Yeah, they may be, throwing some characters together or something into that.
Oh, definitely. I mean, even if you look at a core character like Caitlin Snow becoming Killer Frost, Killer Frost was nowhere near that the character of Caitlin Snow. I mean, later on, they sort of retro-conjure in, but the original character wasn't. So.
Okay.
So they take creative liberties, and, as we often say, things that work on a page might not work on a screen, so you have to adjust things. So I'm still good with it.
Okay. And finally, we have some news out of Sci-Fi about their horror anthology show.
Yes. This is their horror anthology series, Channel Zero, Candle Cove, announced that it will star Paul Schneider and Fiona Shaw. It is a standalone, closed-end season based on Kim Straub's online short story of the same name, set to debut this fall. Paul Schneider is going to star as the main character, Mike Painter, who is a man obsessed with his recollections of a mysterious children's television program from the 1980s and his ever-growing suspicions about the role it might have played in a series of nightmarish and deadly events from his own childhood. And the show has actually been picked up for 2 6-episode standalone seasons, season 2 set to premiere on Sci-Fi in 2017. For this one, the main character, Mike Painter, is a child psychologist who, as a child himself, witnessed the mysterious disappearance of his twin brother Eddie and 4 other children from their small town, Iron Hill, in 1988. And decades later, he is compelled to return to his hometown to investigate what really happened. Only, of course, you find out that whatever it was, it may be happening all over again. And Irish actress Fiona Shaw has been cast as Marla Painter, his mother, who is shocked when he returns home and reluctant to relive those events from so long ago. It's interesting that all these anthologies are popping back up, although this is more of a 6-episode miniseries or limited series rather than the one we were talking about last week, which is straight single episode anthology.
Yeah, it does seem interesting the way that they're kind of doing some of those overarching concepts, even on anthology shows that we've been hearing about recently. But at any rate, It does have certain interesting qualities to it, certainly. I'm intrigued of what it will be. So we'll see what how that amounts, or what that amounts to. Let's see here. About how far are we in here, Edmund?
We are about 35 minutes in.
About 35 minutes. All right, that means we have plenty of time. And I think what we're going to go ahead and do then is talk about a little film that came out a few weeks ago that we haven't really had a chance to talk about quite yet, and that would be X-Men Apocalypse. Yes, having talked quite a lot about Civil War, I guess it makes sense that we would kind of cross over to the, I believe Fox is the one that owns the X-Men franchise, yes?
Yes, yeah, the for now, anyway, separate universe.
Yes, that's right. we did kind of leave out the fact that there are some rumblings that there could be, in fact, some Sony-esque negotiations taking place between Fox and Marvel, or should we say Disney? Disney? Yeah, either one. The Marvel Cinematic Universe, shall we say. It looks like maybe the detente would be over soon, but that having been said, we have a film here that we can talk about. And let's go ahead and start off with just general impressions. Gary, what were your thoughts of X-Men Apocalypse?
I liked it. I mean, for me, they really pulled the heart of this comic book story and, geez, what's the right way to put it? Because I don't mean to say it disparagingly, but they really copied it over and very well. Having read these stories back in the, I guess this is the 90s, the plot line felt very true, while not identical. Still, it really had the characters all seem to have comic book sensibilities about them, and the action moved rather quick. There was a lot less exposition than, no pun intended, than is typical with these movies, and I think it definitely helped that. Most people have some basic clue about these characters at this point, and you don't need more than that to start telling the story. So I'm glad we didn't get that they didn't go too origin heavy, although we still got Magneto's origin again, Cyclops's origin again, and Jean Grey's origin again. And I wish they would just stop that entirely, but at least they minimized it more than they ever have before. So that was a good thing. Some people sort of pick on the villain, but at the same time, I sort of like the idea that he wasn't, that he was more sort of behind the scenes for most of the movie. He wasn't as quite, you know, active a participant in the action. I think that makes for a stronger villain, actually, if he's not getting his hands dirty as often.
How about you, Edmund? Your general thoughts on the film?
I enjoyed it, but kind of felt less satisfied by the end than I did with the first two in this series. And I think the biggest problem for me was even though I see Gary's point about you know it's nice for them not to be going whole hog on origin stories again, but I felt like the new characters and sort of the classic X-Men team that they were putting together, I felt they were giving short shrift to the actual character development to some extent. So while there was good action, I was feeling more of a connection to the established characters, you know, who have carried over through all three films, and actually felt that I wasn't feeling as much of a connection to the new however we want to term it, classic team.
Yeah, I don't know if it's because there were so many negative impressions of the film that I had heard from critics and other fans before I went to go see it, but I actually I didn't think that it was nearly as bad as people said that it was. I think that there were two main things that I maybe wish they could have done. I had no problem with Apocalypse as the general villain. I thought that they did a really nice job of actually portraying his motivations, which have been, you know, not necessarily straightforward in the comics because of various other plots that he is usually involved with. But his original appearance was actually pretty much along the lines of what they showed here. What I think got kind of lost along the way is that while he did create his four horsemen, I don't believe that they actually delved into the horsemen themselves in a way that made them distinct and interesting. I mean, certainly Magneto, they got into his backstory and motivation quite a bit more. and that one made sense, but I don't know that we got to see too much about the others. I mean, there were certain classic things from the comic book story that in X-Factor, which is the book where he was primarily the villain at first, especially in terms of Angel turning into Archangel. And that was far more interesting in the original story than it was here, because we really didn't learn much about Angel to really care about his transformation. And similarly, that's what I was kind of brought to mind, was just all four of them, with maybe the exception of Magneto, we didn't get to see nearly enough in order for us to really understand why they would ally with Apocalypse and what made them distinct. The fact of, also is that one of the interesting wrinkles of the comic book story is that each of the horsemen was, of course, you know, war, pestilence, famine, and death. We never really got that identity from any of the characters here. You could probably kind of figure it out, but it really didn't align in quite that fashion. So it didn't quite go as far as I was hoping it would in that respect. Because I think it would have been interesting to see the formation of the familiar team under Xavier at the same time we were seeing the formation of the team under Apocalypse and the distinctions there. We didn't quite get that. And then the second one, and I didn't have nearly as much of a problem as a few other people I know did with this, but they already have done the big thing where the end of the story is resolved by Jean, spoilers everyone,
yeah,
unleashing the Phoenix Force. It was done much better here, but I think it felt familiar. And when your franchise is, granted, this is a different timeline, but when your franchise is starting to repeat itself like that, you have to be careful. And while I can understand the desire to potentially try to do the Phoenix Saga better than Last Stand attempted, it's not like that was 20 or 30 years ago. It's kind of like the whole idea of, do we need to reboot Spider-Man constantly, right? I'm glad that they're not going to be doing the origin story again. So this may be a little bit too much. Maybe this is kind of like what you were saying, Gary, the retreading that ground that we've seen again. So that was a little bit of a flaw. That being said, I liked Sophie Turner's version of Jean. I thought she was a pretty good young Jean Grey. I thought that her dynamics were with the rest of the team were pretty good, especially with Cyclops. I have no idea how they would expect her to grow up to be Famke Janssen, but so be it.
Yes, well.
She felt much, as what I perceive as the character, she came across as much more cold and aloof than Jean ever did. So I was actually sort of let down, not to criticize the actress per se, but her take on the role I didn't feel fit with my version of the character, at least. But I mean, I understand that's my opinion, but that seemed an ill fit for me.
Hmm. How about you, Edmund? Your thoughts on that?
I don't have as much connection as the two of you to the original. I did read the very original Phoenix and Dark Phoenix saga, over 20 years ago now. As far as within the film, I enjoyed the portrayal quite a bit, and certainly the dynamic with Cyclops in particular, and the sort of sparring and tension there, I thought worked very well, precisely because I hadn't really thought about it in quite some time, but when Gary mentions it, I do see that point that my memory of her from the comics was as a little warmer and even a little bit more of not quite so standoffish, but again, I mean, that was once the team's established, so that may be something they are more working towards rather than a fixed point in time for the character.
And I do want to jump in and say, while it was not original to the story, the inclusion of Jennifer Lawrence as Raven worked extremely well. I was very happy with the way that the character was written, the way she interacted with everyone. I thought it echoed very true to me, even though she was not a character in the original plot line. I think they managed to edit her in seamlessly. It was very well done, and I'm not sure how much they paid her for it, but it was definitely worth it in my book.
Yeah, I'm going to agree. I thought that while some people thought that she was phoning it in, I thought actually that her inclusion in the story made a lot of sense, and I thought that her role at the end of the film actually was a really nice coming full circle type of storytelling. If you look at the whole trilogy from First Class to Apocalypse, her story is a real journey. All of them, in fact. If you look at, you know, Xavier, if you look at Magneto, if you look at Mystique, those three central characters that are the core, actually, yeah, they are, they go through quite the journey in these three films. And I think that gets lost on some people. I think that they overlook that.
Well, I think one of the things that hurts it is that while, you know, Jennifer Lawrence is portraying her, Mystique is actually supposed to be a contemporary of Xavier and Magneto, yet she comes off as much younger, and but she's not written that way, so I think it introduces a bit of a confusion to some people.
Yeah, it could be. It could be.
But certainly, I would say. I wasn't aware of those criticisms, and it doesn't really make sense to me because I thought the character's development makes perfect sense across the three films, and certainly her desire to step back after the events of Days of Future Past, did ring very true. I found it rather intriguing of her being this sort of transitional figure between Xavier and Magneto, and this younger generation, which sees her in these sort of legendary terms because of those events 10 years ago or so.
It's interesting to me that there is the implication that we know from the end of Days of Future Past that the end of that film, which is, you know, Logan seeing that people who used to be dead are now alive and everything else, that literally nothing that happened up to that point has to have happened in the original timeline. Now we're in a different timeline. And that being the case, whatever happened in the original X-Men and X-Men 2 and Last Stand, all that is more or less wiped out. And this film just underscores that. I think that the big question that we had after Days of Future Past was, where is the break? Where is the, where does it diverge in terms of timeline? And now we know. Certainly, there. If you go too far in terms of trying to make all the films fit together perfectly, you're going to very quickly see huge gaping plot holes.
Yes.
In fact, just in terms of casting. But that all being said, I think that, one of the fun crack things about X-Men comics in general was the fact that it felt like everything fit together pretty well as long as you didn't give it too much thought, especially lately. But during the Claremont years, certainly, he would be able to take things that seemed like plot holes and make them seem like grand plans, which was always part of the fun. I just happened to enjoy this because I loved Apocalypse as a villain. I thought that they did a nice job of clarifying his motivations. Oscar Isaac does a really nice job. I don't know why people are so negative about his performance. I really don't. I think that it makes perfect sense. But then again, I'm not looking for him to be chewing the scenery or being like a big physical villain. He never was that big of a physical presence. It was always what he prompted others to do, it seemed like. So I enjoyed it. I don't think that it's quite on par with, say, Civil War, but I think that it is a worthy entry into the X-Men film franchise. What I think we haven't talked about yet is it was not quite a cameo. I don't know why people called it a cameo either. I thought it was a rather extended and important plot point. The Weapon X sequence, which again, it kind of throws things into confusion. But certainly I thought that it was an interesting way to presage the fact that they basically revisited a location for one of the other films and kind of, again, changed up the timeline slightly, but then alluded to the fact that these elements still exist out there. They just are being rearranged somewhat because we had the Weapon X program at Alkali Lake again.
Well, mm-hmm. I still think it was a gratuitous cameo. I mean, if you think about I still don't feel it significantly bore on the plot in and of itself of him being there.
It's certainly, did they force the plot to go into that direction so that they could have that cameo? I'll grant you that. But if you have them show up there for the reasons that they do, they wound up making it make sense within the story that they would be there, and then it would make sense for him to be there as well. I think the timeline lines up. What I think actually this exposes as a bigger problem is, these characters look like they haven't aged very much for it being 20 years between First Class and Apocalypse.
Yeah, well.
That one, I think, is a storytelling conceit that didn't work quite as well for me. But Edmund, how about you in the Weapon X segment or crossover or whatever?
I mean, I mean, I certainly recognized it. I wouldn't say I found it jarring, but I think that was more just I mean, what you were referring to in terms of where even in the comic books things don't necessarily hold together. It was more like, you know, oh, they're going back there again. I wasn't really trying to or expecting to be able to figure out a way to make it all hang together. I certainly enjoyed I wouldn't call it a cameo either. I mean, you know, Wolverine, you know, popping up in that sequence and proving crucial certainly to the mission working out. I really kind of enjoyed the little I hope we don't see him again at the end.
Yeah. Boy, that guy, jeez. Yeah. Yeah. The reason I say that it's not a cameo is that normally I think of a cameo almost like Stan Lee, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's never important to the plot or integral or in the story. We're here. Like, cameo would be his little appearance in First Class.
Yeah.
This was more than that to me. So it may not have been a major role, but it was a role. And it's interesting, I guess, that you kind of, because he was so central to Days of Future Past, is continues to flesh out his story arc, even though he's not one of the main characters of these, you know, in the sense of the trilogy per se. But
yeah, I can see that point.
I guess if you were to take the two trilogies together, you could kind of look at it as his story at least kind of fits together. Kinda. Anyway. Kind of like anything does in this franchise. But Gary, what kind of score would you give this one, do you think?
Are we doing our typical TV score of 10? Or?
Yeah, sure.
I'd probably go in 8.5. I really enjoyed it a lot. Everything fit together really well for me. I sort of like this idea of them picking the best storyline out of a given decade and bringing it to screen. And so I was already scouring what 2000 plot lines and that they might possibly go in. I will have to see if my guess is right later on. But I like this idea that they are cherry picking the best of the X-Men storylines to go to the movies with, and not just continuing to do origin stories.
How about you, Edmund?
I think I would weigh in with an 8. And also, just want to clarify one thing, because when you were mentioning about the two different teams, I think it wasn't just that I was feeling there was a little bit of short shrift on the X-Men side, but there was absolutely short shrift on the Four Horsemen, just the barest brushstrokes of character and where they came from, I think that would be my primary criticism.
Well, I'm not completely disagreeing with you, but at the same time, I look at, say, like Psylocke, for example. They gave us just enough to sort of know where her motivations were going to go and stuff like that. So did I need to see what town she grew up in? No. I don't necessarily need a villain fleshed out to know, did he wear, jeans to school in third grade? I just, sort of want to know what the motivations are, and let's keep moving on.
I actually wouldn't mind exploring more about her character in particular, because her decisions seemed to be important. So it was like, there did seem to be, when you got to the end, the stakes for the Four Horsemen themselves didn't quite add up. But yeah, she was so prominent in some of the things that were happening that it did feel like maybe there could have been some more connective tissue there. And who knows, maybe there's some scenes that were cut out. That's what I'm particularly keying in on. I would probably agree more with Edmund on an 8 than an 8.5. I don't think it was. I wouldn't give it nearly as an average rating as a lot of the other critics did. But I certainly feel like this maybe was a step down from Days of Future Past and First Class. Of the three films, it is the weakest. But that's still not saying a whole lot disparaging about it, because it's still a pretty damn good film. It's certainly better than Last Stand was.
Yes.
By far.
Yeah.
So, which the people who say that it's worse than Last Stand, I think they need to go back and watch The Last Stand again. But hey, the final film of any trilogy is usually pretty hard to pull off. See also The Hobbit. Anyway. that's it for this particular discussion of X-Men Apocalypse, and it is actually the end of this particular episode. So when we come back next time, what we are going to do is we're going to get into our episodic discussion, and boy, there's one particular episode that comes to mind that's probably going to take a little while. I'm just thinking. It's possible. Until next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates, but let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.